This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix GoToMeeting, personalized meeting rooms to help put your best face forward. More at gotomeeting.com.
Coming up on the program today, in no particular order, the computer chips that make your cars smart, the economic curiosities of the British election, and making your fortune on Etsy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Full Sail University, offering accelerated master's degrees that start every month at fullsail.edu/masters. By Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle. Farmers Insurance, know the gaps. And by RingCentral, the cloud communication system that integrates with CRM, sales and support applications like Salesforce, Zendesk, Box, and now Google for Work. More at ringcentral.com.
From the studios of KQED in San Francisco, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 5th of May. Great, as always, to have you along for the ride, everybody. We're going to start today with trade. First of all, an indicator, and then a little bit of trade policy. We learned this morning the trade deficit, that is the gap between how much stuff we import and how much stuff we sell overseas, hit a 6.5-year high in March. We are buying a whole lot of stuff, not selling much at all, relatively speaking. That might bode ill for first quarter gross domestic product when it is finalized. The policy bit, meanwhile, is very much front and center in political Washington. We've talked a good deal on this program about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, the proposed free trade deal between the U.S., Japan, and 10 other countries that the president would really, really, really like to get done. There are no small number of stumbling blocks, though, and a couple of big ones, including complaints about the very fundamentals of how these types of agreements are negotiated. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
Negotiations are a lot like chess. You might have heard that one before. But in trade negotiations, instead of two players, there are maybe a dozen, each one thinking about their best move, each trying to minimize the threat of other pieces on the board.
It's a long, drawn-out process.
Ishwar Prasad, a trade policy professor at Cornell, says working out these deals can take years.
Typically, these finer points of negotiation are not made public. Generally, there is awareness of what the big issues are.
But there's a reason the details are private, says Gary Huffbauer with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He was a trade negotiator in the 70s.
To reach an agreement, one party or the other has to be seen and reported to be giving up, making a concession, you know. And since negotiations are all about compromise, that really makes compromise much harder.
Huffbauer says there is some legislation pending that could open up parts of the process. But he thinks making negotiations public in real time would basically kill these deals. Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat from Ohio, thinks the public should know what's in the deals, especially when they're close to final. He can read them.
As long as there's a United States trade representative sitting there, I can't take notes and take them out of the room. When I'm back in Ohio and my staff can't go in there, even though she has all the clearance necessary to get access to CIA and Department of Defense documents.
He says controls like this make him question what there is to hide. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
More than 250 businesses were damaged during the violence in Baltimore last week, but one store in particular became something of a symbol of it, and now maybe a symbol of better things, too. City officials have confirmed that the burned-out CVS store at the corner of North Avenue and Pennsylvania in West Baltimore is going to reopen, along with four other CVSs that were damaged. From Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
Most afternoons, Chantria Davis sits on this street corner in front of CVS, waiting for the bus so she can pick up her kids at daycare. Today is no different, though the drugstore behind her is still boarded up and covered with fresh graffiti. If it weren't, she'd probably stop in and buy something.
I use the CVS just about every day.
The area surrounding the store is known as a food desert, a poor neighborhood without easy access to a lot of fresh produce and healthy food. Davis says for her and her neighbors, this store is more than a pharmacy.
From the toiletries, the snacks, the food, juices, and, you know, personal items and everything.
The chain drugstore has almost become the general store these days.
That's Jim Hertel, a food retail consultant with Willard Bishop. Decades ago, many supermarkets moved out of the inner cities for the abundant real estate and parking of the suburbs. Hertel says pharmacy chains like CVS, Walgreens, and Rite Aid saw an opportunity to fill the void. And in recent years, those stores have expanded their grocery aisles and added fresh produce.
They've got almost a free run with little competition in those neighborhoods.
Still, the city had to fight to bring in the CVS at Penn and North more than two decades ago. More recently, city developers scored a big victory when a Target moved in, not far away. It was also damaged during the riots last week. Jay Brody is former president of the Baltimore Development Corporation, which promotes business in the city.
It took us at least 3, maybe 5 years to convince Target that this was a good place.
And $15 million in tax breaks to redevelop the area. A city official says CVS didn't get any incentives to rebuild its damaged stores and didn't ask. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, things started off bad, got worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A report out in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences says chemicals used in fracking have been found in drinking water in Pennsylvania. There have been all kinds of suspected and hotly debated claims of such contamination. This is one of the very few, though, that have been put out there on the record. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on the story for us from our sustainability desk. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so what happened here?
Well, what happened is in Bradford County, Pennsylvania, and there's already been a question of natural gas contamination in people's drinking water. The state regulator concluded that natural gas contaminated people's drinking water, and the company settled with families. This is a few years back. And so now we have a question of chemicals in people's drinking water. And the study found that chemical used in drilling and fracking, those are two different stages, turned up in people's aquifer. Now, what's notable, Kai, is this is public data. Very often in these cases, there's a fight, there's a lawsuit, there's a settlement, and the parties agree not to disclose any information, and so all the data goes into a black hole. In this case, we have a published study.
All right, here comes the big question then, Scott. How did the chemicals get into the water?
We're not really sure. The authors say the most likely path is what's called bad well construction. Now, ideally, you drill and you put a pipe down underground, and then you put another pipe on the outside of that, and then you put a third pipe on the outside of that, all for protection, and then you put cement in between all of these pipes. Now, operators say that's actually not that easy to do well in every case. And I spoke to Rob Jackson. He's an environmental scientist at Stanford, and he says very often that's the weak part in this whole oil and gas production process, the well itself.
Hmm. The integrity of the well near the surface is the key to safeguarding water quality. Problems with poor cementing, cracks or leaks in the casing, or even in this particular case, the lack of cement, can lead or make it more likely that problems happen.
Now, Rob Jackson has been criticized by many in the industry, but he actually says problems like these are few and they're actually fixable with the right standards and perhaps some new rules.
You said industry, Scott. What is industry? Yeah. What is oil and gas, big oil and gas saying about this?
Publicly, they're not giving an inch. Very often, industry representatives tried out the word never contaminated drinking water. And here they argue there's no direct proof of how these chemicals traveled from the well or from the surface into the water. And they also say this is a very small quantity of chemicals. Now, all that is true. Now, it's also true the driller settled for a lot of money with people who sued the driller. And it's true that the gas contamination didn't happen until the drilling started. And the only contamination in this case is very close to the well site. So you have these competing views in this broad debate. One side says, can I prove it to me? And the other side says, let's proceed with caution. And that's where we are.
Yeah, just to wrap it up, Scott, we were talking, yesterday, right, about these fracking bans and how states are overruling localities. Does this change that state of play at all?
Well, critics of the process say it could. In their view, this is another piece of data, public data, that will eventually push the industry to change. Now, perhaps cases like these are already changing industry practices. Also, this spring, the EPA here in Washington is supposed to release the final draft of its study on fracking and drinking water. A lot of people have been waiting for this study. And this study is going to incorporate its findings from this county, Bradford County, Pennsylvania.
Scott Tong with the latest on the fracking story. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome, Kai.
The Brits wrap up a neat and tidy 6 or so week-long national election on Thursday, and despite what seems on the face of it to have been a solid, if budget-cutting economic program, the ruling coalition led by David Cameron and the Conservative Party is in some trouble. Opposition Labour is doing well in the polls. The election may well not be about the economy, stupid, as it turns out, and that might cost Prime Minister Cameron his job. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
He's a born winner, clever, accomplished and wealthy. He's won all life's glittering prizes with ease. But as Election Day looms, Prime Minister David Cameron seems to be losing his cool.
Taking a risk, having a punt, having a go, that pumps me up. And it's what is changing our country. We've got a fight on our hands. Am I going to win that?
Not real tub-thumping, it's true. But for a smooth operator like Cameron, this is raw aggression.
And if I'm getting lively about it, it's because I feel bloody lively about it. That's the truth.
For once, life must seem grossly unfair for Cameron. He could easily lose office in this week's election. And yet he's cut the budget deficit in half, unemployment's down to around 5.5%, and the economy's growing quite strongly. Ted Malloch is an American economist based at Oxford University.
We have a situation in the UK which is actually, from an external point of view, an objective point of view, looks quite good when compared to the rest of Europe. So I don't know why anybody would change horses in the UK economy, certainly in midstream.
Forget to vote Labour on May the 7th.
On the campaign trail, Cameron's Conservatives or Tories are more or less level pegging with the opposition Labour Party.
May the 7th, vote Labour.
Which some financial analysts, like David Buick of stockbrokers Panmure Gordon, find mystifying, given Labour's economic record when last in power 5 years ago.
Labour lost total credibility, made an absolute mess, virtually destroyed the country.
Labour blames global forces for the worst economic crisis since the 1930s, but Buick accuses Labour of fostering a debt binge by the government and by households. He fears for Britain's future if the party gets back into office.
For business, industry and commerce, a Labour-led coalition or a Labour government would be an unmitigated disaster.
But on the doorstep, out campaigning with a Labour candidate...
Would you be interested in voting for the Labour Party?
Possibly.
OK.
I found a very different frame of mind. Many voters, like these who didn't want to be identified, do not give the Cameron government any credit for the economic recovery.
The average man on the street, my friends, they don't feel any better off now than they did at the start.
And you don't either?
No, I definitely don't. Hasn't trickled down.
I would question a lot of those figures.
You don't think Britain is really recovering?
There's certainly been no improvements in my life and those around me.
The growth in average pay has been fairly feeble. Social mobility's declined. The gap between rich and poor has widened, compounding an image problem for the Conservatives, underlined in one of the campaign's big TV events.
Seven party leaders go face-to-face, live, in the ITV Leaders Debate.
In this televised debate, the leaders of some of Britain's smaller parties lined up to denounce the Tories and pledge not to form any kind of alliance with them.
I will never, ever do a deal with the Tories. Let me make
I that will not to... prop up a Conservative government.
We would do nothing to prop up a Tory government in any way at all.
For many voters, Cameron's Conservatives have become a kind of pariah. They were the party for winners and for everyone else who aspired to get on in life. But Liberal Democrat blogger Matthew Green says the party has lost a lot of that appeal as upward mobility dwindles and pay stagnates.
That is starting to make a lot of people lose faith in the idea that prosperity is there for all who work hard. That started to put other people off the whole sort of self-reliance philosophy. That self-reliance started to become heartlessness.
In the words of one leading Conservative politician, the Tories are widely seen as the nasty party. In spite of their economic competence, an outright Conservative victory in this week's election seems all but impossible. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I needed to make money to pay for financial loss that we had had. I didn't want to lose our house.
Fear is as good a reason as any to make sure your small business succeeds, I'd say. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lopped off 142 points, 0.8%, ended things at 17,928. That, I imagine, or what, the Wawa mandolins? I don't know. The NASDAQ swooned 77 points, 1.5%, finished at 49.39. The S&P 500 off 25 points, 1.1%, closed at 2,089. Sales of Frosted Flakes, Pop-Tarts, and other Kellogg breakfast brands, down. Sales of Cheez-Its and Keebler cookies, down. Kellogg shares off 1.5%. The bright side, though, is that new in your grocery store, gluten-free Special K. Lots of speculation about Salesforce.com. Is it for sale? Who's the buyer? Salesforce does customer relations software, and it's in the cloud. The hot air floated Salesforce 1.6% higher today. Bond prices, why they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.17%. They're probably not mandolins, right? What are they, banjos? You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Emerald Data Solutions, makers of Board Docs and supporter of the Park City Education Foundation's Running with Ed, May 16th in Park City, Utah. Learn more at runningwithed.com. By the Society for Human Resource Management, HR professionals rely on SHRM's competency-based certifications to help make the new workplace work. Learn more at shrmcertification.org. And by Battelle. Battelle's airport bottle scanner can detect threats in seconds. Learn more at battelle.org. Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its preliminary first quarter productivity and costs report. The Senate Special Committee on Aging discusses aging in place. Can advances in technology help seniors live independently? And tomorrow is International No Diet Day. Now this is something I can get behind. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Citigroup analysts had some nice things to say about Texas Instruments today. They kept their buy rating on the stock despite a disappointing earnings report a couple of weeks ago. TI, of course, makes semiconductors. Semiconductors that most people probably associate with calculators, right? The Dallas-based company, though, has a history of adding to its profits by making microchips for cars. Profits that will likely only increase as consumers demand fast, high-tech computers in their high-tech cars. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman explains how TI got in the car business anyway.
In the 80s, Texas Instruments was excited about its microchips in a hot toy called the Speak and Spell. TI's Speak and Spell used the first single-chip voice synthesizer, a tiny device that just a few years later gave one beloved alien a voice.
E.T. Home phone.
E.T. took advantage of the microchip, and later, some Chrysler vehicles.
Don't forget your keys.
And those little computers are still in your car today, usually without that nagging voice.
Most of the major car brands have TI technology inside of them that you don't even know about.
Automotive manager Kurt Moore says TI microprocessors are in Fords and BMWs, where they help control everything from car windows to power steering. So why isn't the average driver familiar with the company's car accessories? Maybe it's because of the names.
Called AM1810.
The QNX Car 2 software platform.
Across the Cortex-A, the R, and the
Jacinto 6E. Break through the car processor jargon, and you'll find a multi-billion dollar industry shaping your driving experience. Inside TI's Dallas showroom, music blasts from a new car infotainment system. Kurt Moore says car companies are turning to chip makers, demanding newer, faster microprocessors to build their high-tech cars.
What we've got here is we've got a heads-up display. And what that heads-up display would allow the driver not to take their eyes off the road, but still be able to see the information they need to see.
So these displays are a sort of alert system for drivers. Cameras outfitted on the car monitor the surroundings and then project images in a corner of the windshield. Here, in this model car, the windshield shows a traffic sign and two pedestrians up ahead. Both are outlined in neon green.
So the system would recognize that this is a caution sign, would recognize that there's two pedestrians in front of you, and then it could automatically help the car stop and prevent an accident.
In 2013, just 2% of cars used heads-up displays, and most were luxury. Now, automakers are taking advantage of cheaper cameras and processors from chipmakers like TI. They're outfitting more affordable cars with this collision avoidance technology and fancy dashboards.
So for the chip makers, it's an extraordinary opportunity.
David Sedgwick is a senior writer for Automotive News. He says chip makers are all fighting to get their silicon in your car first.
It's going to be a dogfight because no one knows quite how to do this right yet, but they feel they can't afford to wait.
And the big growth area for chip makers now? Self-driving cars. So for TI, investing in smart car technology was easy math. No calculator required. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Shares of Etsy, the crafts marketplace that went public a little bit less than a month ago, picked up almost 4% today. It's nice, but shares are still well shy of their IPO day pop, about $30 there. It's tempting to think of Etsy's sellers as being on the smaller side of small business, and a lot of them are. Alicia Schaefer, though, most definitely is not. She is the second-ranked merchant on the entire site, selling women's clothing and accessories, and lots of them at her shop. It's called Three Bird Nest. It was not, however, an instant success. Alicia, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I don't imagine that when you started this business, you set out to be number two on Etsy, did you?
I set out to be number one, so I still have work to do.
So you failed. Get off the interview, go back to work.
Yeah, no, I actually didn't have any anticipations, quite honestly, of it even turning into a true business.
And we should say this is your second business, right? The first one kind of didn't go so well.
This is my third business.
All right.
The first one did not go well at all. The second one was the brick and mortar store that I had kind of led my path into where I am today.
You decide to get into Etsy and Three Bird Nest that way. Tell me about the thought process. What made you say, Etsy, yeah, I can do this?
You know, for me, Etsy was a great place to start because the marketplace was there. I didn't have to invest a lot of money into getting people to come to the website organically and paying for SEO. And I didn't have to do any of that to start. So I think a lot of this was really in the beginning was out of necessity. I needed to make money to pay for financial loss that we had had. I didn't want to lose our house. And knowing that I had an opportunity to not make the same mistakes from being a business owner that I had previously, and putting those to work to my benefit and loving every second of what I do has made a huge difference.
I was about to ask you about fear as a motivator, mm-hmm. because that seems like what was going on in the beginning, but clearly not now. If you love mm-hmm. every second of what you do, fear is no longer yep. the motivator.
You know, and I think it's good to have a little bit of fear in you, because for me personally, the first business I had, it did good. I am totally okay saying I was a little cocky. I felt like, you know, no one was going to take me down, and I have this great brand and people know who we are, and I'm selling to all these big, you know, brick and mortar stores, and that's not good. You need to have a little bit of fear in you to keep you on track. And I think it's made me appreciate every single customer that gives me a penny to buy something from us.
I'm trying to figure out how you got as big as you are in this space with $0 spent on advertising and marketing.
Yes. It's so important for Three Bird Nest as a brand to have everything that we touch, our customer sees, to be something they connect with. So that goes from our photography to how we respond to emails to how we get in front of our customers. Social media has been huge for mm-hmm. us. And the last year has been explosive for us because we have been interacting with our customers more. We want their feedback. Do you like this shoe or this shoe? And I think that's exciting to people. They like to be part of what's coming next. And I think that's fantastic. It's exciting for us to see it too.
What's the hardest thing? What's the most challenging thing about this?
Logistics.
Really?
Logistics, without a
fulfillment?
Doubt.
Fulfillment?
Fulfillment. Yeah. We have had a disaster with fulfillment, ooh, quite honestly. It's what we're dealing with right now. And it's something that I've never had to manage or deal with before. Mm-hmm. It's just the little things to me that have made such a huge difference that we've lost in that transition, which we're now bringing back in-house. So I'm working on that huh. right now, and it's crazy exciting for me because that's really our next step. And
you're back to the fear, actually, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, it's scary. I'm going to have this huge project coming on that tackling it now versus what we were doing a year ago is something completely different. Hmm. So I'm excited to grow that and to, you know, see where that's going to take us in the next year.
That's pretty good. Alicia Schaefer is the founder and president and CEO, and I imagine whatever else she wants, at Three Bird Nest. Alicia, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, which A, might not be suitable for the younger members of the listening audience, but which also, and I'll pause here if you need it, it also does give you a whole nother level of respect for Microsoft. According to the emoji tracking website Emojipedia, and yes, that's a real thing, the software company that everybody loves to hate is going to introduce a new emoji when it rolls out its Windows 10 operating system later this year. It is technically called, this new emoji is, reversed hand with middle finger extended. You can call it what you like, just don't do it to me.
Marketplace is supported by MailChimp. More than 7 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. More at MailChimp.com. By Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Far From the Madding Crowd, the new film based on Thomas Hardy's classic love story, in select theaters now. And by Dollar Shave Club Monthly Service, with customizable delivery of three different razors and products to the doorsteps of their million-plus members, dollarshaveclub.com.
All right, we are out of here. The Dow off 142 points today, 0.8%. The NASDAQ down 77 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 dropped 25 points lower, 1.1%. Thanks today to the staff here at KQED, where I seem to be spending a whole lot of time lately. Caitlin Esch and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.